think we were on page 37, paragraph 100. Now, there are four kinds of virtue or sila. And the first is called patimokkha restraint. That is keeping the rules in the disciplinary code for monks and nuns. And that patimokkha restraint is undertaken out of faith. So having faith in the Buddha and his teachings, monks and nuns keep these patimokkha rules intact. And the next one, the restraint of the sense faculties, is to be undertaken with mindfulness. In fact, the restraint of sense faculties is not strictly sila or virtue. It is a control of one's senses. So control of senses can be done by mindfulness, or should be done by mindfulness. When someone sees an object, one must keep mindfulness with him or with her so that he or she does not get unwholesome thoughts or unwholesome mental states with regard to that object. And in order to guard against unwholesome thoughts entering our minds, we need mindfulness. So the second sila, or the restraint of the sense faculties, is to be undertaken by mindfulness. So by mindfulness, one tries not to take the signs, or not to apprehend the signs, and not to apprehend the particulars, but just one tries to stop at seeing, hearing, and so on. In paragraph 101, when not undertaken thus, virtue of patimokkha restraint, what is missing there? Restraint also is unenduring. If we do not undertake the restraint of sense faculties with mindfulness, then the virtue of patimokkha restraint, the first one also, cannot endure long and cannot stay long. So it does not last like a crop not fenced in with branches. As it is raided by the robber defilements as a village with open gates is by thieves and so on. So the patimokkha restraint becomes enduring when the restraint of sense faculties is undertaken by mindfulness. Because when we apply mindfulness and try not to take the signs or particulars of the object we experienced, then we will not come to the transgression of the rules in the patimokkha. And with regard to the restraint of sense faculties, the story of Elder Wangisa was given. So he went out for alms, and he saw a woman, and he had thoughts of lust arise in his mind. And so he asked Venerable Ananda what to do. And Ananda said, because you perceive mistakenly, because you see that person as a person or as a woman, you have these kind of thoughts. So try to concentrate on the formation as alien, as suffering, as not self. And if you have this attitude, this understanding, then you can extinguish this fire of lust in your mind. So the elder expelled his lust and then went on with his Armstrong. So he tried to expel these thoughts from his mind while he was going on arms. And then two stories were given. So these stories are inspiring stories, how monks control their senses. One monk did not know that there was painting in the dwelling, and the other monk, the same monk, he doesn't know whether when the king bowed down before him, he did not know whether it was a king or a queen. So he always say, "May the king be happy, whoever bow down before him." And down the page, there's a verse, "Let him not be hungry-eyed." The Pali word is lola. Lola means unsteady, or looking this way or that way. That is called lola. Hungry-eyed means the same thing. Here, hungry should be understood not in the sense of wanting to eat something, but hungry for the visible objects.
Well, is it in the sense of distractible?
Yes. So monks are taught to keep their eyes down, especially when they go into the village or into the city. So they are allowed to see about 6 feet in front of them. And so they keep their eyes down. So they are not to look at this thing or that thing. And so when your eyes is starting from this object to that object, then it is called in Pali lola, lojana.
Hungry-eyed is not a particularly often used English word. It's not a phrase that we use a lot.
I see. Maybe the word lola can be translated as hungry, maybe. But lola is something like not steady, not composed. That's lola. And then another story on page 40, Elder Mahameda. So these stories are not difficult to understand. So the third, livelihood purification, that is a third virtue for monks. So livelihood purification is to be undertaken by means of energy, by means of effort. Because if you are lazy and if you are a monk and you are lazy and do not go out for alms, then your livelihood will not be pure. So livelihood purification is to be undertaken by means of effort or energy. So in order to keep the livelihood pure, a monk has to avoid wrong search or unsuitable search for things. And in order to in order not to resort to such things, then he has to go out for alms every day. And down about the bottom of the page, there is saying, and if he has got putrid urine with mixed gall nuts, actually, this is gall nuts soaked in urine. And it does not necessarily mean putrid urine. Although the word puti in Pali is used here. So it's just urine, cow urine especially. Do you know gallnut?
No.
I don't know. The other name is a myrobalam. M-Y-R-O-B-A-L-A-M or B-L-A-M. Myrobalam. It is a kind of a fruit, a nut. It has a bitter taste. And it is soaked in cow urine, and it's supposed to be medicinal.
Ah.
So, if a person gets that kind of gold nut or that kind of myrobalam, or the full sweets, so they are supposed to be medicine for monks. The one is not so good, but the full sweets are good things. Then he who keeps his who wants to keep his livelihood pure should take what is not good and give good to others. The four sweets are a medicinal sweet made of four ingredients. What are the four? In Buddhist countries, in our countries, it's very usual. I mean, very common. Almost everybody know at least the thing which monks can eat in the afternoon. And these four things, four sweet things are ghee, honey, oil, and molasses. They are mixed. And if you are to be strict, then you are not to cook on a fire. You can put it in the sun and then stir. And sometime afterwards, the mixture become a little thick. So that could be eaten in the afternoon, if you are weak or if there is some kind of ailment to be got rid of. So these are called four sweets, chettu madura.
So this last part means if you're offered both of these medicines and you take the one that's not so good tasting and leave the good tasting medicine for others, that's a virtuous act.
That's right.
Okay.
So such a monk is called supreme in noble one's heritages. Now, some kind of hinting or indication of these things are allowed with regard to some requisites and not with regard to other requisites. So paragraph 133 talks about that. As to the rope and other requisites, no hint, indication, roundabout talk or intimation about ropes and alms food is allowable for a bhikkhu who is purifying his livelihood. So a monk must not ask for requisites, not even hint or indicate or use a roundabout talk to get a robe or to get food. But a hint, indication, or roundabout talk about a resting place, about a dwelling place, is allowable for one who has not taken up the ascetic practices. So these are allowable for monks with regard to dwelling place. And a hint is when one who is getting the preparing of the ground, etc., done for the purpose of making a resting place is asked, what is being done, Venerable Sir? Who is having it done? And then he replies, no one. That means there is no one who is going to build this place. So if you can, please build, something like that.
If you can, please?
Please build this place for me, something like that. Or any other such giving us. And indication is saying, Lee follower, where do you live? In a mansion, Venerable Sir. But Lee follower, a mansion is not allowed for bhikkhus. This is an incorrect translation. But Lee follower, is a mansion not allowed for monks?
No.
Because a mansion is allowed for monks.
I see.
So, is it not allowed for monks? You live in a mansion and where I live in a hut. So that is indication or any other such giving indication. Roundabout talk is saying the resting place for the community of bhikkhus is crowded. So the monastery is too small, and it is not enough for monks or lay people to assemble. And that is something like a roundabout talk. That means build a new monastery, at an extension to the monastery. So these are allowed with regard to resting place or dwelling place, but with regard to robe and alms food, they are not allowed. All, however, is allowed in the case of medicine. So medicine is a necessity, and if you have an ailment or disease, you really need medicine. And so with regard to medicine, all these hinting and others are allowed. But when the disease is cured, is it or is it not allowed to use the medicine obtained in this way? So there is two difference of opinion with regard to this. Vinaya specialists say it's all right, but Sotana specialists say no. Vinaya specialists say Buddha has permitted, and so it is right to use medicine obtained by hinting and others even after the disease is cured. But Sotana specialists say no, because although there is no offense, although there is no breaking of a certain rule, there is no breaking of a rule, Nevertheless, the livelihood is sullied. So it is not allowable. And if you want to purify your livelihood to the utmost, then do not use them. And so the story of Venerable Ananda and Moggallana is given. Venerable Sariputta and Moggallana is given here. And also Elder Mahatesa, the mango eater who lived at Chiragomba. And the story is given in the footnotes. Now, virtue dependent on requisites. That is the last of the four kinds of virtue. Virtue dependent on requisites means actually reflecting on the four requisites whenever you make use of them, or when you get them and also make use of them. So this is to be undertaken by means of understanding, because you have to reflect. Say, I use the robe just to get rid of heat, or just to ward off heat, cold, bites of insects, and so on. So you have to use your understanding to reflect. Therefore, it is to be undertaken by means of understanding. And these reflections are given before, right? Yeah. Now, paragraph 124. Herein, reviewing is of two kinds, at the time of receiving requisites and at the time of using them. Sometimes you receive a robe today and you may not use it until a month later or 2 months later. So there are two kinds of reviewing, at receiving and at the time of using them. For use is blameless in one who, at the time of receiving robes, etc., reviews them either as mere elements or as repulsive, and puts them aside for later use. Here also, the translation is a little inaccurate. So here, what is meant is, say, a monk, when he receives the robe and others, he reflects or reviews on them as mere elements or as repulsive, and then put them aside and later make use of them. Not just put them aside for later use, but put them aside and then later make use of them. And in one who reviews them thus at the time of using them. That means You have to review both at receiving and at the time of using. Although this passage may imply that even though you review at the moment of receiving, and if you do not review at the time when you use, then it is all right. But the emphasis here must be on reviewing at both times, at receiving and at the time when you make use of them. And here is an explanation to settle the matter. So there are four kinds of use. So four kinds of use are mentioned here: use as theft, use as debt, use as an inheritance, and use as a master. Now, use as theft is by one who is unvirtuous and makes use of requisites, even sitting in the midst of community, is called use as theft. And here, unvirtuous really mean who has broken a monk, who has broken one of the four most important rules. Because if a monk breaks one of the four most important rules, he is no longer a monk. He may be wearing robes and he may be claiming as a monk, but in reality he is not a monk. And so his use of requisites is said to be by theft, because he is not entitled to receive offerings given by the lay people. And so it is like stealing something. So it is called use as theft. So here, unvirtuous means the person who is no longer a monk. And use without reviewing is use as a debt. Monks depend on lay people for these requisites, and lay people offered them to monks. And so they have this responsibility to reflect or to review on these four requisites. And so if a monk does not review when accepting or when making use of them, then he is said to be using as a debt, or he is indebted, and so he must review them. When? The rope should be reviewed every time it is used. Every time you pick up your rope, then you have to review that I use this rope just to ward off cold, heat, bites of insects, and so on. And the arm's foot, lump by lump. Every morsel, right? At every morsel, at every mouthful, and you have to review. So that is why talking while eating is discouraged for monks. A monk who talks while eating is supposed to be of bad behavior, because instead of reviewing, he's speaking, and when he speaks, then he loses reviewing.
In our meal chant, we say the first portion, but we used to say mouthful, when we always said portion is for the precepts, the second is for the practice of samadhi, the third is to save all beings. So that reviewing is is in our meal chant.
Good. So you have to be doing something when eating, thinking of something. So when you eat without reviewing, you are using it as a debt. So the alms food, lump by lump. One who cannot do this should review it before the meal, that means in the morning, after the meal, in the afternoon, or in the first watch of the night, or in the middle watch, or in the last watch of the night. If dawn breaks on him without his having reviewed it, he finds himself in the position of one who has used it as a debt. So before dawn, because in Vinaya, in the disciplinary rules for monks, days are reckoned by dawn. So dawn is the beginning of one day, not midnight or sometime after midnight. So the day is reckoned by dawn. So when the dawn breaks and a monk does not review at all, then he is said to be using the requisite as a debt. Also, the resting place should be reviewed each time it is used. When you go into the monastery and go out of the monastery, recourse to mindfulness both in the accepting and the use of medicine is proper. So, with regard to medicine, you have to review both in accepting and in making use of it. But while this is so, though there is an offense for one who uses it without mindfulness after mindful acceptance, there is no offense for one who is mindful in using after accepting without mindfulness. You may accept it without reviewing, but when you are using, you must really review it. That is what is meant here. Now, purification is of four kinds. Purification by the teaching, purification by restraint, purification by search, and purification by reviewing. This is also this has also to do with the four virtues or four silas. So the first, purification by teaching. Now the word teaching is not correct here. There are two translations of Visuddhimagga, the English translation. One was made by a Burmese gentleman, and the other by Nyanamoli. But both of them did not get the right translation here. The Pali word here is desana. D-E-S-A-N-A. And the word desana generally means a sermon or a teaching or a preaching. But here, desana is used in a technical sense in Vinaya. And desana in Vinaya means revealing, or revealing one's offense or confession. So, purification by confession. So when a monk has broken a rule or more rules, he has to confess it to another monk. So when he has confessed, then he gets free from the offense of breaking that rule. So there is a kind of sila which is called purification by confession. So by confession, you can get rid of this offense. These are minor rules in the Padimokkha, cutting a tree. So monks are not allowed to cut trees. So if a monk cuts a tree or pluck a flower or a fruit, then he comes to a minor offense. And in order to get free from that minor offense, he just have to confess it to another monk. But there are some graver offenses which needs not only confession but staying under probation for a period of time. And also there is the grievous offense, transgressing which a monk becomes automatically becomes a non-monk. So in that case, giving up robes is called a purification. So giving up robes and becoming giving up monkhood. I mean, so becoming a samani, becoming a novice or becoming a layperson is called purification there. So by purification, the Patimokkha offenses incurred by breaking Patimokkha rules can be by confession can be purified. And purification by restraint, that is the sense restraint of sense faculties, that is called purification by restraint. And the third one, the livelihood purification, is called purification by search, because you have to search for food, especially food, and search for means, search for by suitable means, and not by asking or not by begging, by word of mouth. And the last one is purification by reviewing. So in order to purify the last of the four silas, you make review, you review whenever you receive a requisite or make use of a requisite. So these are the four purifications corresponding to the four silas. And then use of the requisites by the seven kinds of trainers is called use as an inheritance. Do you know trainers? What are trainers? Now, I think you know there are eight noble persons, or eight kinds of noble persons. You don't know? There are four stages of enlightenment. You know that? Four stages of enlightenment and eight types of consciousness that arise at the four stages of enlightenment. The path of stream entrant, the fruition of stream entrant. The path of once returner, the fruition of once returner. The path of non-returner, the fruition of non-returner, and the path of arahant and fruition of arahant. So the eight types of consciousness. And it is said that there are eight enlightened persons or noble persons. In Pali, the word is Arya, A-R-I-Y-A. You may be familiar with the word Aryan. So the person at the moment of stream entrant path consciousness is called a first noble person. And then the person at the fruition moment of stream entrant is called the second noble person, and so on. So there are eight noble persons, eight kinds of noble persons, not eight noble persons. Now, what are trainers? Trainers here means those who have attained to lower stages of enlightenment. Briefly, trainers are those who are neither ordinary persons, neither puttojanas, nor an arahant. So they are stream entrants, once returners and non-returners. They are called trainers. In Pali, they are called sekhas. They are not puttojanas, they are not ordinary persons, and they are not arahants. So they are used as an inheritance. But how then is it? Is it the Blessed One's requisites or the laity's requisites that are used or that they use? Although given by the laity, they actually belong to the Blessed One, because it is by the Blessed One that they are permitted. Because Buddha permitted us to accept things from lay people. It is virtually the requisites of Buddha and not of the lay people. And so when a a son uses it's his father's belonging, his father's requisite is said to be using as an inheritance. That is why it should be understood that the Blessed One's requisites are used. Confirmation here is in the Dhammadhyada Sutta. That sutta is in the Majjhima Nikaya, middle length sayings, the third sutta. Buddha said in this sutta that be the inheritors of Dhamma and not of requisites. Buddha urged his disciples. Used by those whose kankhas are destroyed, that means used by those who are arahants, is called use as a master. For they make use of them as masters because they have escaped the slavery of craving. So try to, from among these four, try to make use as use as a master is the best one. But for those ordinary people who have not yet attained any stage of enlightenment, there can be no use as an inheritance and also no use as a master. So there are only two. Are they two? Use as theft or use as debt. But the commentator said, the use made by those who keep their precepts, who keep their virtue pure, could be included in the use as inheritance. Because it is the opposite of the use as a debt. So for one possessed of virtue is called a trainer too because of possessing his training. So this is stretching the meaning of the word. The word trainer or the Pali word seeker really means those persons who are neither putojanas nor arahants. But here, with the stretching of the meaning, a person who has good sila, although he is a putojana, can be called a trainer here. So his use of requisites is could be included in the use as inheritance. As regards these three kinds of use, since use as a master is best, when a bhikkhu undertakes virtue dependent on requisites, he should aspire to that and use them after reviewing them in the way described. And there is one sentence missing here. I don't know why he left it out. For he who so does is one who does what is to be done. That sentence is missing.
That comes after he should aspire to that.
After them in the way described.
Uh-huh.
For he who so acts is one who does what is to be done. And then the stanzas are given. And on page 45, in connection with the fulfilling of this virtue dependent on requisites, there should be told the story of the novice Sankarakita, the nephew. So he was eating and his preceptor said, don't let your tongue burn or don't burn your tongue. So he was not eating hot food at that moment, but the preceptor said, don't get your tongue burned. That means don't eat without reviewing. And so he became an arahant later. Now, in paragraph 131, about the middle of the paragraph, that of magnanimous ordinary man devoted to profitable things. So magnanimous ordinary man means a putojana, an informed putojana, or a good putojana. And devoted to profitable things really means devoted to vipassana, meditation. And the number of precepts given here, Nyanamoli has a different number than we traditionally is interpreted. So traditionally, the number of the rules for monks is 9,000,000,000 and 180,000,000, then as well, and 50 plus 100,000, and 36 again to swell. The total restraint disciplines. These rules the enlightened one explains, told under heads for filling out which the discipline restraint contains. So traditionally, the number is, what do you write down? 9 1 8 0 5 0 3 6 0 0 0.
It's a lot.
Because for one rule, there are many minor offenses, minor rules, pertaining to one rule.
91 billion, right? 91 billion.
Trillion.
Trillion?
I don't know.
1,000,000,000,000.
Okay, then. So we take pride in saying that I'm giving 91 billion precepts. Now, in paragraph 134, the magnanimous ordinary man's virtue, which from the time of admission to the order is devoid even of the stain of a wrong thought because of its extreme purity, like a gem of what? Purest water. What does that mean? It doesn't make sense, right?
No.
Like a gem well polished. That is the meaning. Well washed or well polished.
Oh, I see.
Not of purest water.
I see.
And then a story. So we'll skip the story. Stories are not difficult to understand. And then more stories on page 48. The one who broke his legs and asked the robbers to let them practice meditation for the night. And he practiced meditation on the pain caused by the broken bones. And at dawn, he became an arahant. So he meditated on the pain. Pain becomes his object of meditation. And then, on page 49, the quotation from Patisambhida, that's not so easy to understand. We can just skip it. The In the case of killing living things, abandoning is virtue, abstention is virtue, volition is virtue, restraint is virtue, non-transgression is virtue. And then the others are given here, one by one. In the case of taking what is not given, in the case of sexual misconduct, in the case of false speech, and so on. Even in the case of first jhana, the hindrances, the abandoning of hindrances is virtue. And in the case of second jhana, the abandoning of applied thought and sustained thoughts, or initial application and sustained application, is the virtue, and so on. So on page 51, paragraph 141, and here there is no state called abandoning other than the mere non-arising of the killing of living things, etc., as stated. Now, abandoning really means not letting them arise. Because if they have arisen, then they have already arisen and you cannot do anything about them. But here, abandoning really means